Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, I've been trying to corral one of our new neighbors, still new neighbors in Chapel Hill, and that's Jim Sasser. Jim Sasser is a former United States Senator, three terms serving from the state of Tennessee in our Senate, and after that served a term as ambassador to China. So you got him in Chapel Hill. On my mind, at the top of the list of things that we're worried about are what's going on in Washington and what's going on over in China. And Jim Sasser, I hope you'll be available to add to our scant store of knowledge and wisdom about those two places.
Well, I hope so, D.G., and it's a real pleasure to be in Chapel Hill, have such a warm welcome, and see so many nice neighbors here.
Well, what a great addition you all have made to Chapel Hill, and one day we'll just have to have a big celebration for having you here, but right now I want to exploit you. We have a new president, and our new president's gotten in interesting situations over many things, but one of them has to do with China. At that point, I think President-elect took a telephone call from the president of Taiwan or of nationalist China and thought that was a great thing to do to, for some reason. What's the problem with our president talking to a representative of a very important player in the Southeast Asia?
Well, that contravenes about 40 years of American foreign policy. It was during the Nixon administration when Henry Kissinger hammered out an agreement with China called the One China Policy. And in that, we recognized that there was just one China and we would recognize and deal with just one China as a sovereign state. And that was an ambiguous agreement. But since that time, we have not dealt on a state basis, that is leader-to-leader basis, with the authorities on Taiwan. The Chinese look at Taiwan as a renegade province, something that a territory that's rightfully theirs, that Chiang Kai-shek, when he fled the mainland, set up the nationalist government there after he failed on the mainland. And it's a primary thrust of Chinese foreign policy that they want to unite the mainland with Taiwan. It would be like us perhaps saying that Hawaii, now a state, that the Chinese president was talking to the governor of Hawaii as if it were a sovereign state instead of talking to the president of the United States.
Well, we deal with in Trump's defense, we deal with Taiwan in many ways as if it is a sovereign state. And, I mean, we even have some responsibility for keeping Taiwan safe. We trade with them. We deal with them in many ways. It's kind of a complicated thing maybe that Trump didn't understand.
Well, I think he obviously didn't understand it, and it is a very complicated relationship. But the Taiwan question is at the very core of the Chinese foreign policy, and that's the most important question that the leaders of China and the people of China are concerned about. They're still trying to reunite the old Chinese empire. They have taken back Hong Kong. They've taken back Macau from the Portuguese. These have all been peaceful resolutions of those matters. And they want to take back Taiwan.
But we don't want them to take back Taiwan, do we?
Well, I don't think we really care whether they take back Taiwan.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
We've said in the past, during the Truman administration, that Taiwan was outside of our ring of defense. Now, after the Chinese came into the Korean War, that's when we sent the 7th Fleet into the Taiwan Straits to try to keep keep the Chinese out of Taiwan. But this is an old question, D.G. It's been around for a long time, and it's well settled that there is a one China policy that the United States adheres to, that we have a diplomatic representation in Taiwan, but it's not doesn't have the status of an embassy. And we deal with Taiwan on an economic basis, and we have an obligation called the Taiwan Defense Act to defend Taiwan to a certain extent, and we sell a lot of weapons to Taiwan. But underneath all that is sort of a sense that Taiwan is an island with 30 million people, And the mainland China has 1.4 billion people. And the economics of the situation are bringing them closer together all the time. For example, when I was the ambassador to China, Taiwan citizens were one of the principal manufacturers in China. There was the a bank in Shanghai that was a Taiwan bank. And as the wage rates went up in Taiwan, Taiwan manufacturers came to China to do their manufacturing. So there's a web of economic ties there that are really powerful. And I think if you took a poll of the business people in Taiwan, they probably would favor some kind of reunification. The political establishment in Taiwan does not want a reunification. And the populace of Taiwan are very suspicious of mainland China. They don't want mainland China ruling them either. So it's a complicated situation. But over time, I think it's going to work itself out over a period of years. And I can get into that deeply, more deeply if you want to, but there have been a lot of rapprochements between, to use the French phrase, between the Taiwan, the authorities on Taiwan and the government on mainland China.
Well, a lot of Americans, I think, would, as you point out, we have some obligations to the Taiwanese to defend them in the case of an attack. So that it's complicated in terms of what our relationship is. We say there's one China, but China, if you try to take over Taiwan militarily, we're sorry, but we're obligated to have to jump in.
Well, it's a very complicated relationship. As I say, when I was a ambassador to China, the Chinese were trying to influence the elections on Taiwan. They were firing missiles into the Taiwan Strait, and President Clinton sent two battle groups down into the Taiwan Strait to try to rectify the situation. And that resolved itself. Not to the Chinese liking, because the person they did not want to get elected got elected.
But at the same time, you're saying to them, we recognize the one, we're not backing away from the one China policy, but be careful how you intervene in your one China's breakaway province.
It's very ambiguous and was purposely done that way, to save face on the part of the Chinese and to save face on the part of the United States.
Now, let's say you're sitting, or Trump would have been fortunate enough to have you sitting by his side, either at the time the telephone call from the president of Taiwan came or at the time it was being planned. And what would you just say, be careful?
Or
you
no, I would discourage him from accepting the call. We've never had a direct communication between the President of the United States and the leader of the government in Taiwan really since, I guess, the late mid-70s.
Well, so Trump made a mistake. Are there long-term consequences to that?
Yes, there could be long. It's interesting to watch the Chinese government and their spokesman. When Trump was first elected, took a pretty sanguine position on it. They said, well, he's a businessman and we've done business with business people before and we think we can work something out with him. Then he took the call from the president of Taiwan, and that set off all kind of alarm signals in mainland China and in their government. Then later on, when he made his statement about taking the call, That raised more hostility in the People's Republic of China, that is the mainland China. And then his nominee for Secretary of State, now the Secretary of State, Mr. Tillerson, made some fairly aggressive statements about what the United States would do in the South China Sea. So now the Chinese have gone from a benign view of the Trump administration to one of alarm about the Trump administration now. And this could be ultimately a very dangerous situation.
I want to talk some more about that. Let's take a quick break and come back and talk about the possible dangers that the situation in China presents us. In case you joined us late, I'm visiting with our Chapel Hill neighbor, Jim Sasser, former ambassador to China and former U.S. Senator. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Jim Sasser, our neighbor here in Chapel Hill, also a former three-term United States Senator from Tennessee and also the ambassador to China. And I'm pumping him now to help us understand the situation our country faces with China and our particularly with respect to the relationships between China and our new president. And we talked about that initial – what most, I guess, Jim, with you would say that the president had made a faux pas by talking to the president of Taiwan. But there are other things. If you were advising President Trump and you had 5 minutes to brief him on things that he should be watching out for and the way he might be handling things, what cautions would you give him?
I would caution him. I'd say, number one, that Taiwan is at the core of Chinese foreign policy interest. And you're playing with fire in trying to realign the relationship between the United States, Taiwan, and mainland China. That is an issue in which I think the Chinese would probably go to war over. Number two, I would...
you just say that one more time because might say, would go to war.
I think so.
With us?
Yes. If we tried to... that's the one thing I think that the Chinese that's so important to the Chinese and goes so deeply into the Chinese culture and their character and the basis of their thinking about foreign policy. That yes, I think that's the one thing that we could have an armed conflict over.
The armed conflict is not so much a missile attack on the United States, but is the in the Taiwan Straits that the Chinese would engage our Navy and send their troops towards something along those lines, a localized war.
There. Well, perhaps, but you never know. Once these things get started, they can escalate, and the Chinese now have rockets that they call carrier busters that they can use to sink aircraft carriers with. Now, what are we going to do if they sink one of our aircraft carriers with 4,000 or 5,000 of our men aboard and they all become casualties or die or drown?
So that's one of your cautions to
the first
President
caution,
Trump. Be careful about this because this is not just a game that we can play.
Yeah, this is what the Chinese call a core issue. The second thing I would remind him of is that the Chinese now have the second largest economy in the world. And at the rate they're growing, they'll probably overtake the United States economy by 2030, most economists say. China is now the largest trading country in the world. And China now is working diligently on building a blue water navy. They've gone from a green water navy.
Can I stop you on the economy and the productiveness of the Chinese? Wouldn't President Trump say, "Well, Jim Sasser, thank you for mentioning that, but that's exactly what I'm worried about, is that they are abusing their strong position to the detriment of the American economy, and I'm going to stand up to him, and you don't want me to do that."
Well, I think there needs to be some recalibration of our relationship with the Chinese on an economic basis.
So you would agree with the – you would encourage the president in the proper way to pursue –
Well, I would encourage him to proceed with prudence and caution but firmness in dealing with the Chinese on economic on economic disputes. We have seen since up until 2008 – the Chinese were fairly submissive or almost subservient to the United States and the West on a lot of issues. But since 2008 and the financial crisis, the Chinese have now come to the conclusion that their system is better than ours. Their economic system is better than ours. And so they become more aggressive. And they become more aggressive under this new president Xi Jinping. And they now have the second largest military budget in the world after the United States. And we've got to realize that China is going to become a regional power. And while we're building walls to wall ourselves off from the Mexico, the Chinese are building railways all the way across Southeast Asia to Thailand, through Thailand, all the way to Singapore.
That's not necessarily in our detrimental interest for there to be a prosperous Southeast Asia.
No, we have always said that we welcome a prosperous but peaceful China and have encouraged what we think is the peaceful rise of China.
So do you tell President Trump that the growth of the Chinese economy is a good thing for us, or is it it's a challenge that we need to stand up to them about?
Well, it's both. When I say recalibrate our relationship with China, American companies are big in China. For example, Buick's manufactures and sells more Buick automobiles in China than it does the United States. Ford Motor Company is there. General Electric. Almost any major American multinational corporation is operating in China. But now, since 2008, the Chinese have been putting some restrictions, increasing their restrictions on American business. And I think we need to be firm in our dealings with the China on China on economic issues.
If you're Trump's ambassador, and you all are having this conversation, and you say, "Mr. President, you need to be firm," and he says, "Jim, go tell them what they need to know and what they need to do, and I'll back you up." What would be the right kind of message that's both sensitive to the positive aspects of China's prosperity, but is also in line with the United States' interest in terms of having fair treatment from this growing powerhouse?
Well, on the economic front, the Chinese, I would say to the Chinese, you've got to do something about these surplus industries that you have and quit dumping your surplus on the world market. China overproduces steel. They overproduce aluminum. And they dump that on the world market and depress not only U.S. steel prices and put U.S. steel workers out of work, but the same in Western Europe. And I would say you've got to deal with your own surplus problems, and you cannot export your economic problems to us. In other words, we've got our own economic problems. You have built up a middle class using Western technology and Western capital, and our middle class is suffering partly as a result of this. So we've got to have more equal treatment, and you've got to take more of our product and more of our exports, and we may take less of yours.
Well, I may be reading you wrong, but I hear you as being in line with the new president's – with President Trump's sort of view of China as a challenge, and how does view differ from what you feel he might be doing?
But you can't do it by tariffs and getting into a trade war with China. If you get into a trade war with China, that will translate to a trade war with all of Asia.
If you put a tariff on the overproduction of, say, steel, and what other tactic or strategy do you have to attack the Chinese overproduction and dumping, other than placing a tariff on undervalued or on products that are being sold at less than they cost to manufacture them?
Well, take up the complaint with the World Trade Organization. I mean, China's a member now of the WTO. File a complaint with the World Trade Organization.
Have we not done that?
We've done that in some instances, and we won on every one of them. And we'd even instituted some tariffs on not tariffs, but duties on Chinese automobile tires. And that works to some extent.
So I'm gonna,
but if you do it across the board, what you're going to get are the Chinese reciprocal trade barriers from the Chinese. For example, Chinese, one of the largest purchasers in the world of Boeing aircraft. And or the Chinese will say, well, we're not going to allow General Motors to export any more of their parts into China to be assembled into Buick automobiles. We're not going to let Ford export any more parts to be assembled in China to build Ford cars. We'll put tariffs on them. So you've got to, you don't want to get into a trade war with the second largest economy in the world, which will be the largest economy in about 15 years. So you've got to work out some kind of modus operandi where it's mutually beneficial to both countries. And you were not, I'll tell Trump, you're not going to do that by throwing down the gauntlet and putting a high tariff on Chinese goods coming in. You've got to work through the established international organizations to deal with it, and you've got to put subtle pressure on the Chinese.
If you join us late, we're visiting with Jim Sasser, our neighbor here in Chapel Hill, former U.S. Senator and Ambassador to China. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with our Chapel Hill neighbor, Jim Sasser, and pretending that he is advising our new president. I want to...
Let me make this clear. I don't want the job of advising the
new
president.
Well, I was really just... he
D.G.
just called me and said, would you interview him and see if he could help us? Well, it's obvious what you told us, that the advice, if he's in a moment of relaxation and sanity, he would probably agree with much of the advice that you gave him, maybe not in terms of exactly how to implement it, but in applying with strength a reasonable standing up to the Chinese aggressiveness in terms of protecting their economy. I want to move to one other aspect of policy with respect to China that concerns me and I have no answers for. But if President Trump said, Jim Sasser, you know the Chinese, and we've got this complicated situation now where the Chinese are moving into areas which we think are international waters or claimed by other Southeast Asian countries, and they're militarizing them. And it looks like it's going to develop into more of, at some point, there's going to be a conflict about it. What should I do about this?
Well, I would say that we need to be firm in insisting on international law in these areas. And let the Chinese know that we're going to enforce international law, and we're going to do it on an equal basis in the sense that we're going to enforce international law and the law of the sea not only against China but against other nations in the region. For example, the Philippines, Brunei, Vietnam, all are claiming many of these same areas that the Chinese are claiming. And I think we need to be even-handed in telling the Chinese we're going to enforce international law against them as well as against the other countries in the region. Not to let the Chinese think we're pinpointing them, but we're being even-handed in our insistence on international law. Now, with regard to these islands that they've been building, that's a problem. And I'm not sure exactly – it's unclear what the solution to that is. But I do think we need to continue to do what we're doing, and that is sailing American naval vessels close to them and saying that and not recognizing Chinese sovereignty over these areas when it's contested with other countries in the region. When you've got other countries claiming the same pile of rocks that the Chinese are building these small airfields on.
Well, just earlier we were pretending that I'm Trump and I'm trying to get your advice on these issues. And you said you cautioned President Trump and me that as far as Taiwan is concerned, that is a core issue, that the one China thing is something that the Chinese would go to war about. To what extent do you think that the Chinese historic claims to dominance in the South China Sea and their commitment to solidify that claim is the same kind of core issue as the Taiwanese?
I don't think it is the same kind of core issue. And I think I don't think they would go to war over something like that. I think we just need to be firm in our dealings with the Chinese in that particular area and deal in, and move in concert with our allies. I mean, we're allied with Australia, Singapore, Thailand, Vietnam, Japan.
You hadn't named anybody who is a great military power yet.
Well, Japan is, and Australia is to some extent, and can be if they want to do more. But we have to realize that that the Asia and the South China Sea is to some extent to the Chinese maybe like the Caribbean or the Gulf of Mexico is to us. And we have to give them a little leeway in some of those areas.
How do you give them a little leeway in terms of fortifying these islands? And
well, that's where diplomats come in. That's where diplomacy comes in.
Well, if you're the diplomat and you go calling on the foreign minister in Beijing of China, and how does all that work?
Well,
you say we're not going to put up with this anyway. We're going to what are we going to? He's going to say this is a don't mess with us or you will retaliate.
No,
we'll
I don't think they would be that blunt about it. And in dealing with them diplomatically, you have to find something that's important to them that you have some control over. And the American markets, for example, are important to them. We're their largest customer, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And they hold they're the largest buyer of our government bonds, for example. They've got over $1 trillion worth of U.S. government
securities. So we threaten not to sell them bonds anymore.
We can threaten to manipulate our currency, which will devalue their bonds. I mean, there are always ways to do these things. And you can't and the Chinese are not going to come at it from the point of view of their uppermost in their minds is the stability of the Chinese government and stability in mainland China. That's what they fear more than anything else is instability. And so you can find ways, I think, to work around these issues, just as Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon found a way to work around the Taiwan issue. And they worked out a solution that has
a beautiful solution that some of us have trouble understanding.
Well, that's exactly what it's all about. It's a solution built on ambiguity.
Well,
and I think Henry Kissinger would tell you that if he asked him. But it's a solution that allows the Chinese.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with the former Chinese ambassador, former American ambassador to China and former United States Senator from Tennessee, now a proud Chapel Hillian with us. But he's got wisdom that the rest of us don't have. Jim, we talked about a number of things, and you mentioned earlier that maybe it would be well to at least mention the challenges that both China and the United States and Japan and the rest of the world face with respect to North Korea. The killing of a member of the ruling family in North Korea, the continued and seemingly improved capability, continuing testing and seeming improved capability of the North Koreans to deliver nuclear-armed missiles a great distance, all of which worries us. And then recently we've been complaining about China not doing anything, and recently they've said, we're not going to buy any more coal from you.
That's exactly right. And DGE, if I were advising President Trump on this, I would say, you take credit for this. Now, whether or not he actually deserves the credit is another question.
Where did that come from? How can you imagine what prompted the Chinese to do?
Well, it's unclear. It's whether the last missile that they fired just was too much, it just said we've got to do something about it, or whether they're reacting to Trump's tough talk and trying to throw him a sort of a bone to speak. It's unclear.
But let me ask you this, because this is what jumped into my mind right away and wondered, since you know more than we do about how people think about this, whether or not this calculated assassination of a North Korean pretender who apparently had close connections to China, whether or not that just shocked them and they made an impulsive decision to do this.
It may have. It's as I say, it's unclear. There are any number of things, but the relations between China and North Korea have been bad for a long time. And when I was in China, I remember that the Chinese sent their troops into the North Vietnamese embassy. It was something you just
North Korean.
Into the North Korean embassy in Beijing, they sent troops armed with submachine guns in there to get a person out that the North Koreans was holding for some reason. Now, that's
a great violation.
It's a grave violation, and nobody said anything about it because nobody is concerned about sticking up for the North Koreans, and the North Koreans did not advertise it themselves. But the new president of China, I say new, he's been the president now for a number of years, Xi Jinping, does not like this young fellow who's the president of North Korea. They've never met. The Chinese actually think those running the North Korean government are, quote, crazy, close quote.
Well, why don't – I mean, they could pull the rug out from under them, couldn't they?
But the problem that the Chinese have is they fear that if they put too much economic pressure on North Korea, this fragile economy will collapse. And when it collapses, the government collapses, and then China's going to have a flood of Korean refugees coming across the Yalu River looking for sustenance and employment. Secondly, they fear that if this government, they puts too much economic pressure on it and this government collapses, then the South Koreans and the Americans will take over North Korea and they'll have American troops up on the Yalu River again, which the Chinese went to war with us once over that. But I think the Chinese may just have about had it with the North Koreans. Kim Jong-un murdered his uncle, who was sort of the Chinese counterpart, the Chinese agent, or
the uncle was not a part of the Chinese establishment,
no.
But he was friendly to China.
Yes, he was the lead. He was the lead man who would negotiate with the Chinese, and the Chinese trusted him, and he was well known by the Chinese leadership.
This is brand new to me.
Yeah.
And so talk a little bit more about this, so that the counselor to the North Korean leader who was executed recently with all kinds of fanfare. This was a special dig at the Chinese because this was one of the people in the North Korean government that the Chinese felt comfortable dealing with.
Well,
and it was almost like they were saying to the Chinese, we don't care what you think about it.
Well, I think that's true. In other words, Kim Jong-un, who at that time I think was 31 years old, saw his uncle as a threat to him. And the uncle had loyal followers inside the North Korean government and also was the chief go-between between North Korea and China. And Kim Jong-un saw that as a threat, and the Chinese resented very much the loss of the source of the uncle after he was murdered. Now, there is some intelligence of our intelligence community view the half-brother of Kim Jong-un, who was just killed in, was it Malaysia?
In Malaysia. Kuala Lumpur Airport.
As also with close ties to the Chinese. He had been living in Macau, which is the old Portuguese possession that China now takes it, now runs. Some talk that he was really being supported financially by the Chinese. So
this is just so important to me in terms of my new information. So that the trying to put myself in Ung's shoes, mm-hmm. he no longer views China as a great ally, but he views them as plotting to put him out of business and put somebody more friendly with China in charge of North Korea. And so he's eliminating all of these people.
Well, you never know what's going on in North Korea. And we spend a lot of money on intelligence trying to find out, but really don't know much. But there is a surmise that the Chinese are trying to have more influence. From the Chinese standpoint, the best thing that could happen with North Korea is to get someone running the government who was sort of a puppet or loyal to the Chinese, and they could then use that to do away with this nuclear threat, which they are worried about very much themselves. When I was ambassador to China, I had the Chinese defense minister that I came to know very well tell me that we will not, these are his exact words, we will not tolerate nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula. Now, he was talking about American nuclear weapons, but also North Korean nuclear weapons.
Well, Jim Sasser, I hate that our time is gone because we're just getting into one more new arena where our new president needs help from somebody like you. But thanks for sharing your wisdom with your neighbors in Chapel Hill. Thanks to Jim Sasser, former United States Senator from Tennessee and Chinese ambassador, now our neighbor, for helping those of us who live in Chapel Hill understand the world a little better.
Thank you, DG. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Me too, and thanks to all of y'all for listening. This is DG Martin. I'll be back here before you know it.